Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today I'm pleased to have with us Professor Jeremy Black. Professor Black is Professor of History Emeritus at Exeter University. He is also a Senior Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia, and is without a doubt the most prolific historian writing in the Anglophone world today, having written well over 100 books. Today we are speaking about his book, War in Europe, 1450 to Present, published by Bloomsbury. Welcome, Professor Black.
Hello.
Professor Black, what is the thesis of your book?
This book looks at war and its contexts in Europe from 1450 to the present day. And what I really am taking issue with is the Charles Tilly thesis about war making the state and the state making war. And I'm trying to argue that the military, social, political, and economic dynamics of war in Europe are much more complex than have usually been allowed for. So it's a rewriting of military history, and it's a rewriting of European history.
Would it also be correct to say that you are opposed, and this comes out in the book, to a teleological, or if you like, Whiggish reading of military history?
Yes, I think that's very true. My own fundamental view is that military systems develop that are, in the context in which they are facing, fit for purpose. And the idea that then, therefore, one should have a developmental context in which, shall we say, whatever happens in 2020 is inherently better than whatever happens in 1960 is, I think, deeply flawed.
So that also is part of the explanation about why you are unconvinced, I suppose you can say, diplomatically speaking, by the concept of the, quote, European military revolution, unquote, in the 16th century and later.
I've addressed in a number of books, particularly my book Beyond the Military Revolution, and my books are designed to sit alongside each other. I've addressed that so that I didn't wish to repeat simply what I'd said there. And that book itself looks at it on the global scale. This is a book specifically about Europe, and it's specifically about the nature of military, social, and political interactions.
Now, one of the interesting aspects of the book, which contrasted with most of the treatments of military history, not only in this period, but in general, is that you don't focus on what most other treatments would characterize as key or epoch-making particular battles. Why is that?
Because I think that there is, in a sense, too much of a battle-focused account of military history. As you probably know, the same thing is true, for example, in the American Civil War. Many of the clashes that one is looking at were relatively small-scale, what was called a small war or little war, battles themselves. And I did a book, as you may know, on 70 great battles in history. The battle lists are often highly selective, and one has to be very cautious about how much weight you put on a particular battle. So let's give you a good example. If you're looking at the 30 Years' War from 1618 to 48, and you're just looking at the major battles, which one of Breitenfeld, Lützen, and Nördlingen is more significant. And you've got to be very careful. And, you know, if Breitenfeld and Lützen were deployed in order to argue for the superiority of the Swedish military means, well, how does that deal with the fact that 2 years after Lützen at Nördlingen, the Swedes lose? So I think one has to be much more sophisticated. Again, if you're looking at the 17th century, people have often put a lot of weight on the Battle of Rocroi in 1643, in which the French under Condé beat the army of Flanders, the Spanish army. And yet, as we know, the French don't conquer most of Flanders for another 16 years. So I think one's got to be very careful about this great battles approach.
Why do you say that the ambitions of rulers was the key element in the military history of this period?
Well, I think it's often the ambitions of rulers which explain how they prioritize between tasks and also how they determine what kind of domestic constituency or political alliance among their, generally their social elite, their aristocracy, they're going to be able to construct to what end. So there's nothing in the milk, in the water, you know, there's no equivalent of somebody coming down from Mount Sinai and saying, this has to be your priorities in terms of tasking. And one of the things I've argued repeatedly in my work on military history is that tasking helps to determine your alliances, your force structures, your doctrine, your strategy, the dynamic of military change. And that tasking is not inevitable. So, you know, to use a concept which you and I are familiar with, strategic culture. Yes, there are specifics one can refer to that might, you know, for example, the Russian drive to warm water seas, the French drive to so-called natural frontiers. But how those were perceived and how those were understood in terms of what was believed appropriate is much more a matter of how the individual monarch saw matters.
Why, if at all, did military effectiveness in campaigning increase in the mid to late 17th century?
I would argue that the key development here is the after the so-called mid-17th century crisis, the re-knitting of relationships between crown and social elite, so particularly in France, in Spain, in the Habsburg lands, in Russia, and that what that does is create the social dynamic of elite cohesion with the crown that makes it possible to increase the military effort and to sustain it. So in other words, that is, if you wish to use the term, a sociological or political explanation of military effectiveness and not one based on certain types of weapons or individual tactical formations that go with them.
You seem in the book to downplay the significance of the French army and the French way of war in the late 17th century as a model. Why is that?
Well, first of all, there's been a lot of very good recent revisionist work. I think, for example, the work of David Parrott and Guy Rowlands, which have indicated that the account based on the idea that Letellier and Louvois as ministers of war transformed France so that it became the most effective military power needs at the very least to be qualified. And separate to that, as you may know, I did a book once on French foreign policy from 1648 to 1815. And one of the points I emphasize there is that, yes, France did conquer territory, and some of that territory remains French to the present day, places like Franche-Comté, for example, or Artois. But compared with the major accessions of territory gained by conquest in that period by both Austria and Russia, France, in actual fact, became sort of in relative terms weaker in the European international system. And correspondingly, of course, at sea, it is surpassed, beaten, whatever terms you wish to use, by Britain.
How do you explain the in this almost in the same period, immediately following during the war, the Spanish Succession, the relative or more than relative success of the Anglo-Dutch armies?
Well, again, I think that's an excellent question. Can I say partly, I mean, obviously, this is a question of which context one's looking at. The Duke of Marlborough was very successful in the Low Countries and also, of course, in the Danube Valley at Blenheim. But other British forces, Allied forces, were very unsuccessful when they acted in Spain during what was, in effect, a Spanish Civil War. So there wasn't something uniquely successful about the British model, if you like. I think Marlborough was a very good general. I think that the military administrative system that the British and the Dutch deployed was important. I think the French alliance system fracturing was very significant. I think there was a decline in the caliber of French generals after the Marshal Duke de Luxembourg, although Berwick was very successful in Spain. And I think that much of it, though, also does come down to what happens on the day. Marlborough is extremely good at, as it were, the what almost is a classic technique, which is forcing the other side to feed in their reserves and then smashing through at another point. He does that brilliantly at Blenheim, of course, 1704. By 1709 at Malplaquet, the French have worked out what he's doing, and although he wins there, it comes with extraordinarily heavy casualties. So in effect, what you could argue, and I think I would argue the same thing that you would see with Frederick the Great in the mid-18th century, I would say the same with Napoleon, and I would say the same with the Imperial German Army in World War I and the Wehrmacht in World War II. You can have a capability gap in your to your advantage, but that capability gap ends when your opponent devises the appropriate anti-tactics, as it were.
In the book, you make reference to the relative success of Spanish arms in the period after 1714. Why do you think that most military historians tend to ignore this recovery?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. They do. And I think it's an enormous problem, the selectivity with which people engage in history as a whole. There is a tendency to primitivize the Mediterranean in the 18th and 19th centuries, to regard it as it were, backward. Obviously, you see that in the decline of Spain literature, first of all, in the 17th century, and then into the 18th and the 19th. And I think that there are both inherent prejudices, which I think are a problem. There is also, obviously, the extent to which there is a fascination with what appears to be the cutting edge military. There's this notion that, as it were, is kind of what I've called the baton exchanging approach to military history. So you move from the Spanish army in the 16th century to the French army in the 17th, to the Prussian in the 18th, to the French again in the Revolutionary Napoleonic Wars, to the Prussian again in the 19th. I think this is ridiculous because aside from the fact that you tend to not pay sufficient heed to the particular deficiencies or taskings of those militaries, you don't look more widely. So, you know, to my mind, Spain and, you know, for example, a country which had taken, you know, really difficult civil war, and yet by 1717 has reconquered Sardinia, 1718 lands an expeditionary force in Sicily, 1734 to 35. Recaptures Naples and Sicily. You know, this is a formidable power, builds up a major navy in the 18th century. I think it's very significant, but I'm afraid to say, as you correctly suggest, it doesn't fit in with people's pattern building. And one of the great problems I feel and fear about history is that the tendency to pattern build means that we not only produce a misunderstanding of the past, we also use that in order to produce often very questionable judgments about the present day.
So in actual fact, you do not regard as very revolutionary the employment of tactics by the French revolutionary armies of the 1790s, or for that matter, thereafter by Bonaparte himself in terms of his generalship.
Well, I mean, clearly the French Revolutionary armies were able to survive repeated attacks in the 1790s, and to that extent, revolution was successful. But the idea that they would be able to spread their ideology successfully to, as it were, liberate Europe in their terms. No, that doesn't really work. I think Gunter Rottenberg worked out that roughly when the French and the Austrians fought in the 1790s, each side won about half of the battles. Napoleon, of course, during the 1790s is successful in Italy but fails in Egypt. The War of the Second Coalition puts an enormous pressure on the revolutionaries, and ultimately the failure of the revolutionary system is what provides the background to the Napoleonic coup in 1799. Then if you're looking at the 1800s, there are aspects of Napoleonic war making that are very impressive. The 1805 Austerlitz campaign, the 1809 rejigging of a large army that drives on Austria successfully in the War of the Fourth Coalition. But there are also, as you know, repeated failures. Owen Connolly's book, Blundering to Glory, his argument that at Marengo it was in many senses an accident that Napoleon won. The way in which in 1806, 1807, he was not able to deliver the hammer blows to really knock the Russians out in the latter stages of the War of the Third Coalition. His total failure against Russia in 1812, in which, you know, there is a fundamental misunderstanding, not only at the operational level, but also at the strategic level. So, no, I feel that Napoleon, and again, you know, I'm looking at broader issues and themes of my military history. The fact that somebody can win individual battles does not necessarily make them a military genius. The question is, do you win the war? And in many senses, if you wish to use ahistorically, but they would have thought in these ahistorical terms in the 19th century, Napoleon is more like Hannibal than he is like Alexander the Great or Charlemagne.
So in actual fact, go back to that old historical conundrum, you would see more continuity versus discontinuity in terms of pre- and post-1789 European warfare?
Yes, I very much would. And I would argue that the image which Arthur Ferrell used in his book on Alexander the Great, in which he asks how Alexander the Great would have done at Waterloo, and the point he makes, a very fine passage in the book, he makes the point that, of course, Alexander the Great didn't have gunpowder weaponry, but that essentially you have the same mixture of cavalry and infantry, with infantry using missile weapons, in his case, javelins and arrows, as well as thrusting weapons, etc., etc., that there's similarities there. And I think there are more similarities between 1815 and, shall we say, the Battle of Pavia in 1525 than there are between Waterloo and, shall we say, the nature of conflict by the time you're at, say, the Battle of Kursk in 1943, or indeed by the time you're at the Somme in 1916, where war is much more a process over many days, in the case of the Somme, months, than it is a one-day wonder as it is at Waterloo.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. newbooks.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So in actual fact, that would partly explain why you seem in the book relatively unimpressed with the Prussian military success of the mid-19th century.
Yes, I think that's very fair. I mean, if you're looking at the Prussians, they very much got, as indeed the Germans did in 1939-1940, opponents that played to their strengths. I mean, obviously, Denmark is a weak power. Austria, they don't need to subjugate. What they do is they beat it up in Bohemia, and then Austria essentially negotiates terms. So they get a very quick, short war that they want. In France in 1870 into 1871, it's more complicated. Napoleon III is a terrible general, loses what you might call a war of the frontiers within a month. And at that stage, the Prussians have totally won. And Napoleon III, of course, has surrendered. Then it starts to go pear-shaped for them in the sense that a government takes over in France, what becomes the Third Republic. It decides to go on fighting. The Prussians find themselves committed to a logistical, military, and fiscal strain of the struggle, which they hadn't anticipated. Their armies do, on the whole, reasonably well, though not as well consistently as they had done hitherto. But they're finding occupation problems. They're finding that the war is going on. They need the war to be switched off. And that, of course, is a real problem, that, in a sense, war as an outcome process is very much one which is politically conditioned, notably by how your opponent responds to being beaten up, rather than one that you yourself can determine.
Would you attribute the Russian failures in the Crimean, the Russo-Japanese, or for that matter, in the Great War, in their being unable to successfully fight a war of attrition?
Well, that's, again, very interesting. I think these are different wars. I mean, first of all, the Crimea and the Russo-Japanese War are wars at the periphery. So in 1854 to 1856, the Anglo-French forces do take Sevastopol. But there is no, they are fighting for a limited war goal. There is no, so they send fleets into the Baltic, but it doesn't attack St. Petersburg. There is no march on Moscow comparable to 1812 or, for that matter, 1941. And it's a limited war. 1904-1905, Russo-Japanese War, similar. The Japanese beat up the Russian fleet disastrously for the Russians. They also inflict quite heavy blows on the Russian army in Manchuria, and that's it, limited war, so that in a sense it is possible to get an outcome from it. The Great War, the First World War, I think is rather different. The Russians have a large military in 1914. Indeed, the Germans have been concerned about the build-up of their army after the Russo-Japanese War. But there are problems in generalship. There are problems in what you might call the military-industrial complex. And there is also a fatal lack of an ability to maintain control on the home front. So it's only a relatively small number of Bolsheviks who overthrow the Kerensky government. So the Romanovs have already been overthrown in the February Revolution, but the 1917, but that the Kerensky government goes on fighting. It's only a relatively small number of Bolsheviks that overthrow the Kerensky government, but that essentially is what delivers victory to the Germans. So yes, I think there are multiple failings for the Russians, but it's also worth bearing in mind, as I argued in the book, that Russia, for example, had deployed its forces successfully into Hungary in 1849. It deployed its forces successfully into the Balkans in 1877 to 78. Yep. It had conquered Central Asia, Kiva, Bukhara, Samarkand, Merv in the 1860s, Tashkent in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s. It was worrying the British in the so-called Great Game over Afghanistan and over Persia. So whilst there are deficiencies with the Russian war machine, it's not immediately obvious to everybody that these are going to lead to failure until you get the shock of conflict.
Would it be correct to say that you do not really adhere to the concept of the learning curve to explain the, one could say, belated success of Anglo-French arms in the Great War on the Western Front?
I would say there is a learning curve. I would say there is a learning curve, and I would also say the... in terms of 1917 and 1918, and we have, Charles had a really interesting podcast, which I hope listeners can listen to, on why the Allies won World War One, in which you asked me some really fascinating questions. I mean, what I would say is that in World War One, there are, as it were, for the British and the French, two different types of victory. There's the defensive victory, which is achieved three times. In 1914, when the initial German drive is beaten, subsequently, of course, they also beat the Germans, stop them on their drive to the Channel. In 1916, when the Verdun offensive fails, and in 1918, when the German spring offensives fail. So in those cases, there are three defensive victories, each of which are significant, but each of which are different in their character. And then subsequently, there is the so-called 100 Days Offensive in 1918, in which the Germans are beaten on the Western Front. And there, I think, you see a very rapid but different process of military effectiveness in the various Allied armies. So the Americans, who have to have the quickest learning curve because their forces have come in most recently, do improve their fighting effectiveness and techniques as Pershing and his commanders learn how to adapt to the warfare. But in the case of the British and the French, who've had longer experience, I think the sequential attacks, the understanding of the three-dimensional battlefield, the application of heavy artillery in order to open up the opposing front lines and to interdict their counteroffensive potential, also the benefit on the Western Front of the consequences for Germany of the crises affecting its alliance partners, Bulgaria, Austria, and the Ottoman Empire. All of those are significant. And to my mind, it is a formidable Allied achievement in 1918.
Why did the British Army's counterinsurgency campaign in Ireland between 1919-1921 fail to succeed?
Well, again, I think that's a fascinating question. I think there are a number of issues to bear in mind. First of all, there is the military side, and then there's the political side. As far as the military side is concerned, the military argued that it was because they weren't allowed to use their full force, both in the sense that they were also at that stage having large military commitments in Russia in the Civil War, in Egypt and Iraq, where they were opposing risings, in Afghanistan, where they were fighting the Third Anglo-Afghan War, etc., etc., and also because they were not allowed to use more rigorous tactics. And I discussed that in my book on the interwar period. Politically, I think there's also an element here that first of all, it is the political determination of the Irish Republicans to go on fighting that is important, because in a sense they remain part of the equation, even though they don't control really much territory, but they remain part of the equation simply by keeping going, but also because the British government really lacks an interlocutor with whom they can try and push for a compromise solution. So I think there's a military disadvantages the British have, but also political disadvantages.
How much of the German success in 1940 vis-a-vis the Anglo-French in May and June was due to A, French collapse, B, German military brilliance, or C, plain old luck?
Well, I think luck plays a role, or what I would say, improvisation. I mean, if you look at the fighting on the Meuse crossings, which is really the most crucial aspect of it, it's pretty touch and go. So the Germans at that point, improvisation. The Germans are also lucky that the Anglo-French strategy has conformed with what they, in a sense, need, so that the Mobile Reserve is put on the left-hand side in order to rush forward through northern Belgium and into Holland to protect Belgium and Holland against German invasion, and that enables the Germans to come through a weaker centre without the Allies having reserves. So the situation is very different to the Battle of the Bulge in December 1944, when the Germans again come through a weak centre very bravely, but very held with very few troops in the Ardennes. But there are massive and readily deployed American and British reserves from elsewhere that can be brought up. So partly, yes, improvisation, luck, whichever term you wish to use. As far as the French are concerned, it tends to be forgotten that the French went on fighting bravely. I think I'm correct in saying that they killed more Germans in June 1940 than they did in May. So the collapse is more, I would say, political than military. There was no inherent need for France to, as it were, surrender. I mean, in a sense, the French government was running the second largest empire in the world and still had a significant fleet, and they could have sailed off to Algiers. But there was a degree of failure of nerve in mid-June, and a sense that their duty required them to bring the war to a close. So that element, I think, is important. German brilliance, no. I think that that's overrated. I think Blitzkrieg was more another iteration of German maneuver warfare, and that had its strengths, but also, as everybody was to see in 1941 in the Soviet Union, its serious flaws when it came up against, as it were, defense in depth.
Would you employ or state that the learning curve concept helps to explain Russian military success between 1942 and 1945?
Yes, I do. I think that's very important. There were some Soviet units that fought effectively from the outset in 41, and Zhukov and his men had already put in a good showing against the Japanese in 39 in a short border war. And it's worth bearing in mind that eventually in 40, the Soviets did beat the Finns in the Winter War. Everybody focuses on their lack of success in the first stage, but they did beat them. But I think it's fair to say that in 41 as a whole, although some Soviet unions fought very well, and indeed, I think it's reasonable to say that the Battle of Smolensk on the Army Group Center advance really put sufficient damage on the Germans that you could argue that Operation Barbarossa had already failed. It was certainly off timetable by September 1941. But having said that, The Soviet fighting methods improved. There are still mistakes. The excellent work of a number of scholars, most preeminently the American scholar David Glantz, has drawn attention to failures in Soviet offensives. For example, the Belarus offensive in October 1943, or the way in which the advance into Romania in early 44 went wrong, or the failure of the offensive on the Central Front in late 42. So the Soviets weren't invariably successful, but nevertheless, they had both mastered how to stop the Germans in defense, as it were, the Soviet defense had, and then they had become successively more effective, both in their own offensives and also during their own offensives, at thwarting German counteroffensives. So the last really successful German counteroffensive is the Manstein one in early 43, which consolidates the front line and regains Kharkov. But thereafter, there are no comparable German successes. And, you know, it is an impressive Soviet feat. The Soviets get from the Volga to the Elbe in 2.5 years. That is impressive, just as it's very impressive that the British and the Americans and the Canadians, of course, and the Free French, get from the coasts of France to the Elbe in less than a year. So these militaries have, as you correctly say, had an impressive learning curve.
Would you state that the Anglo-American strategic air offensive against Germany 1942-1945 made military sense?
Oh, it was absolutely necessary. I mean, first of all, it became the prime form of engagement of the Luftwaffe, air defense of the homeland, which, of course, reduced Luftwaffe support to the Wehrmacht. I think that's crucial. Number two, it inflicted enormous damage on the German military system, particularly on communications, particularly on oil production. And as we know, both natural oil, as it ploughed in Romania, but also synthetic oil. And as we know, by 44, the effectiveness of German armor and air units are decreased because they have less oil, their troops are less well trained, because they've had less practice, etc., etc. So yes, I think this was all very significant. And also, I actually think it was very significant politically. I mean, one of the key aspects of World War II is that there is no German or Japanese resistance after surrender. Now, there are a number of reasons for this. The legitimacy of surrender, of going on fighting, was, as it were, ended by the Imperial Japanese surrender by the Emperor, and also, of course, Hitler's designated successor, Admiral Dönitz, surrenders. But I think also the morale of the Germans and the Japanese had been very badly hit by the very heavy bombing. And there's a very interesting piece which came out in the Journal of Military History recently by the American scholar Tammy Davis Biddle, very impressive piece in which she looks at the last 6 months of the war against Germany, and she emphasizes the degree in which the Allied air attack increases significantly in that period. And she links that to Allied leaders being anxious about the resilience the Germans had shown in the Bulge, also the German use of new weaponry, the jet fighter, the attempt of the Germans to develop the new submarine type, and a sense that there had to be a use of all resources possible in order to force the Germans to defeat. And so I think there's not just, as it were, the kind of what I would call the battle of the factories and production in 1943 and 1944, but also I think there is the attempt to dominate the German will in the last 6 months of the war. And I think that, again, is a very necessary feat.
You remark in the book that, quote, military themes played a declining role in the culture of Western Europe in the second half of the 20th century. Why exactly did that occur?
Yes, I think that's, again, very, very interesting. I think it's partly to do with the cultural change from the 1960s on, a kind of greater degree of consumerism, hedonism, individualism, feminization of culture to a considerable extent. So I think that those all played a role. There had also been a compromising of old military elites as a result of the 1940s and what some of these elites had done during the war, but also as a result of political change thereafter. So that while on the one hand you have the citizen under arms, the kind of the fact that in the 1950s most European men, both in Western Europe and in Eastern Europe, were conscripts at some stage in their life, and that in many countries this went on for decades thereafter. You also have, as you correctly say, anti-war sentiment getting much stronger. Now, anti-war sentiment, though, becomes less significant in a way once you get rid of conscription, because you have volunteer professional armies, and those are willing to do what governments regard as necessary, whatever the view of the civilian population. So, for example, I would argue, I have argued, that Britain was able to fight terrorism in Northern Ireland precisely because it had a professional volunteer army. And also, whether you think these were good or bad things, European states were able, those that chose, to take part in out-of-area wars, Gulf War I or II, Afghanistan, French in West Africa, etc., precisely because these were volunteer units of professionals.
What are the origins of what is in the UK referred to as the, quote, military covenant, unquote?
Oh, this is the idea that there is, as it were, a implicit and as well as an explicit duty of care between the military and the ordinary soldiers, with the state being behind that of the military. So in other words, you should only be sent to war for a necessary purpose. That you should be looked after, and that looking after takes a whole host of manifestations. So, for example, at the present moment, to a degree never seen before, there is concern about post-traumatic stress. There is very, there is in the European sense more of an interest in veterans than there used to be, 100 years ago.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
Oh, military history is not some semi-detachable facet of history, though it is, it is still fascinating, but it is absolutely central to how we understand political, social, economic, and cultural history. And linked to that, that all too much of the approach in higher education to history is deeply flawed because it demilitarizes the past.
Upon that observation, which I agree with entirely, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Black, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Coutillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Black.
Thank you very much.